Father in heaven, for Jesus' sake, come into this place, into this time, and let your Spirit direct and guide our conversation tonight. Help us to understand your word better, and help us to see in your word the path to life. For we ask it in Jesus' name, and all God's saints said, amen. There is still more pie at coconut cream. Okay, I'm going to say something to you that you're going to say to yourselves. This has no place in a Bible study, but you'll find out that it does have a place in this particular Bible study. Years ago, as a matter of fact, I can tell you how many years ago, 23 years ago, my sole niece, I only have one niece. I have no nephews and only one niece. Rhonda has many of both, but I only have one. Her name is Emily. And Emily's quite the bright young lady, and she's working on a PhD in chemistry right now at University of Massachusetts. But she's always been a bright girl, always been a bright girl. And even when she was three, she was reading a dinosaur book, a little child's dinosaur book, because that's the sort of thing that in our household my sister's kind of a science nerd, and we do like stuff like that. And so she points to a Tyrannosaurus, and she says the following, you know, please understand, this is an exact quotation. This is an exact quotation, and it will have something to do with what we have to say tonight ultimately, but just understand this is kind of how we're beginning things. We'll get there. What she said was this. That's a T-Rex. He will bite you and eat you, and you will be poop forever. He will bite you, he will eat you, and you will be poop forever. Okay. With that in mind, we turn now to the story of Ahab and his wife Jezebel. Last week, we started this section of 1 and 2 Kings. As I've said to you before, 1 Kings and 2 Kings really is only one book. As a matter of fact, for that matter, 1 Kings, 2 Kings, 1 Samuel, and 2 Samuel is really only one book. Why they got chopped up is beyond me, but somewhere along the line they got chopped up into four books, because I guess it would have been a really, really big book if they didn't get chopped up into four books. So, but now we've gotten to the point where last week we looked at the prophet Elijah, but in this section, the stories bounce back and forth between Elijah being the main character, between Ahab being the main character, and Jezebel being the main character. Each one of them sort of takes the spotlight. So we're in 1 Kings chapter 16. And we're going to get towards the end of chapter 16. And we'll go with the 29th verse. Okay, this is kind of introduces us to our friend Ahab. We'll start with verse 25. Start with verse 21. Oh, no, start at the Genesis 1:1. Just kidding. Okay. It says this. Then the people of Israel were divided into two parts. Half of the people followed Tibni, the son of Githnath, to make him king, and half of them followed Omri. So we have Israel, the northern kingdom, disintegrating. Things are going bad. Not good for them. Omri overcame the people who followed Tibni, the son of Gidath, or Jinath, I should say. So Tibni died. I wonder how he died. And Omri became king in the 31st year of Asa, the king of Judah. Omri began to reign over Israel, and he reigned 12 years. 6 years he reigned in Tisra, and he bought the hill of Samaria where Shemer was from, with 2 talents of silver. That's not very much. That was cheap real estate. And he fortified the hill, and he called it and called Samaria, which is after Shemer. So you ever wondered why it was called Samaria? There's your reason why. And Omri did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and did more evil than all who were before him. Well, that's not real good. He walked in the way of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. You'll remember that has to do with the calves that they made, in the sins that he made Israel to sin.
provoking the Lord God to Israel to anger by their idols. Now the rest of the acts of Omri and all that he did and the might that he showed, are not they written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel? And Omri slept with his fathers and was buried in Samaria, and Ahab his son reigned in his place.
Okay, so we have a very wicked king, and we have another dynasty starting. Again, just to kind of reiterate what the word dynasty means, is that when you have a dynastic succession, that means your son, next, on down the line. It's very, it's kind of a easy way to figure out the problem of who's going to be the next leader. It's pretty easy, because all you have to do is who's the oldest child, and you got it figured out. It's very easy to do. There's only one problem with it. Your oldest son or daughter might be a nitwit. It's true. They just might be. They might just be a world-class goof-off and absolutely useless for leadership, and you have a problem like that. But it's clear and easy, as I said. It's pretty simple who gets the job, because we know who's firstborn. That's easy enough to figure out who gets. Bob, you've been usurped. Your small table back there has been usurped. Yeah. You snooze, you lose.
I can't give him the boots.
No, you can't. Absolutely.
Give him a little soul.
In any case, there you go. However come, we're glad you're here, Bob. Nevertheless, we have Omri gives a rise to his son. Omri has a different way of taking power. There are a lot of different ways to have succession of power, and one of them is through violence. The idea of taking over and having a coup is a time-honored human tradition, and you see it in the Bible, and so you have that with Omri. He rebels against the king before him, and then he also has a rival, and they make sure that the rival gets eliminated. So that's that. Things don't look good in the Northern Kingdom, okay? They just don't. They're going to look a lot worse. They're going to get a lot worse. You know, don't ever say things couldn't possibly get worse. Don't ever say that, because you might be proven wrong and not be happy about them being proven wrong. Don't ever say things just couldn't get worse, because guess what? They could. As bad as things are under Omri, let's read on a little bit further. Picking up with verse 29. In the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, Ahab, the son of Omri, began to reign over Israel. And Ahab, the son of Omri, reigned over Israel in Samaria 22 years. By the way, he's the one that founded the whole city of Samaria. Now, in the New Testament, where do we hear about these Samaria from? Where do we hear about Samaria?
On the road, helping people.
Well, no. Well, sort of, yes. With the Samaritans. Now, the Samaritans were a people that were particularly ornery towards the Jewish people of Jesus' day. The Jewish people didn't particularly care for them, and they reciprocated by not caring for them. So they didn't like each other very much, which is, of course, where the story of the Good Samaritan sort of puts the dig in and makes things a little bit more challenging. So with that, you have Omri to thank for the Samaritans, because he's the one that founded the city. Okay, so he reigned 22 years in Samaria. And Ahab, the son of Omri, did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. Okay, well, we got that down. More than all who were before him. Wow. More than, again, just don't ever say things couldn't get worse, because they're getting worse real quick. All right, before him, that would be enough. We could just end right there. It was worse than before. But it gets worse and worse. And if it had been a light thing for him to walk in the sin of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, okay, if that's all he did, if he only just worshiped this newfangled religion that Jeroboam made up of worshiping these two golden calves, which was sort of a new idea for the Israelites, nobody else around them did that. If that weren't enough, well, he does something else. He marries. He took for a wife Jezebel. He took for a wife Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, the king of the Sidonians. and went and served Baal and worshiped him. If things weren't bad enough, he erected an altar for Baal in the house of Baal, which he built in Samaria. And Ahab made an Asherah, which is an idolatrous item of worship. Ahab made an Asherah. Now, this next one. Ahab did more to provoke the Lord God of Israel to anger than all the kings who were before him. And in his day, Hiel of Bethel built Jericho and laid its foundations at the cost of Abraham, his firstborn, and set up its gates at the cost of his youngest, Segub, according to the word of the Lord, which he spoke by Joshua, son of Nun. Okay, so we got the picture here. We got one bad dude. Yes, Robert.
Is there any significance that they moved the capital to Rez?
Yes, there is. It's called innovation. There is no city there before, and he wants to do something new. And sometimes people just say, you know, I want to do something new and special and different, so I'm going to make my own capital city. You'll know that I happen to be I grew up outside the nation's capital. And people think fondly, well, some people think fondly of the nation's capital. But I got news for you. It's a completely artificial city, or at least it's not now, but it was then. It was on a swamp. There was a guy by the name of L'Enfant, who was a Frenchman, who came up with this idea, says, you know, I got an idea. I want to show my architectural prowess by building all y'all a new city, okay? So we're going to build all y'all a new city. There's nothing here but a rotten, smelly old swamp, and that's really what it was, a rotten, smelly old swamp.
That's why it's called Foggy Bottom.
That's why it's called Foggy Bottom. That's absolutely correct. There's a subway station right there. But, I mean, there's the only thing that was even remotely there was a little place called Georgetown. And the reason why Georgetown was there is because that's where the fall line was, and they could put a mill there. But other than that, let's just make something new and fresh because we want to have this testament to ourselves. Now, we don't think of it that way, but that's what it is. I mean, if you see L'Enfant's plan for it, I mean, it's incredibly grandiose. If you look at other things' plans for it, it's incredibly grandiose for what this city was. It was a perfect 10-mile square. A perfect 10-mile square, which it's not anymore. But in any case, why Samaria like that? I don't know that that's the reason, but it certainly seems plausible because there was nothing there before. It was just a hill that a guy bought for 2 shekels of silver, which really isn't a lot of money if you think about it. So it must not have been, but it was a hill. And so as a hill, it has some strategic value. So, okay. All right. But what I want to give you the picture of is this guy is he's a loose cannon. I mean, he is off the rails. I mean, there's something seriously wrong with this dude. I mean, it's bad enough. It's bad enough that he is the king of Israel and they're in rebellion against Judah. That's bad enough. But he adds to it the whole Jeroboam thing. You know, their kind of worship that they're doing. And he adds to it, on top of that, he adds to it marrying this gal named Jezebel. And we'll talk about her later in the second part, which the quote from Emily will become more apparent when we get to that part. I should tell you a little bit about this guy, Ethbaal, who is the father of Jezebel. I should tell a little bit about him. Ethbaal was a Phoenician, a Sidonian, someone from Tyre, someone same sort of people and same cultural values as the Philistines. I mean, the same group of folks. And we know some stuff about him. I mean, we know stuff about him other than the Bible. And a couple of things that we know about him is this, is that he originally was a priest. Before he was a king, he was a priest of Asherah. Now, you will recall that Asherah is the a female fertility goddess. So therefore, everything that goes with that goes with the female fertility goddess. And so he is a and what does go with that? Does anybody recall what goes with the fertility worship of the fertility goddess? Anybody recall that really wants to say it out loud?
Libido,
absolutely, yes. There you go, Bob. That's a kind way of saying it. The whole cult prostitution thing. So he must have been in charge of all that because he was a priest of this. I mean, he said, well, you know, if someone's got to do it, I guess. So, if you're kind of into that, it's kind of gig, kind of good gig. But apparently not a good enough gig for him because he murders the king. He murders the king of Sidonia or Sidon or Tyre, the kind of two little cities right together in modern-day Lebanon. He murders them. And he becomes king himself. And he sets up his own dynasty. He has quite a notorious dynasty. His granddaughter is very famous for one thing. His daughter is quite famous, but his great-granddaughter is named Dido, D-I-D-O, Dido. And Dido is famous in classical history as being the woman who founded Carthage. Now, Carthage is on the north coast of Africa, in modern-day, I think, Algeria, if I'm not mistaken. I think that's where Carthage is in modern-day Algeria. And Carthage was known as being the rival city-state to the Romans. Hannibal, the guy that took the elephants across the Alps, was a Carthaginian. These are the people who gave the Romans fits forever. And she's the woman that founded that city. But her grand-aunt, I guess that's what it is, great-aunt or grand-aunt, whatever nomenclature you want to do with that, was a woman, of course, by the name of Jezebel. Jezebel, we'll find out more about her in a little bit, but boy, she's quite the gal. But he enters into a marriage with her. So that's kind of a little idea of what's going on. So, you know, we had Solomon marrying the Egyptian girls, and we had also marrying the girls from Moab and all that other stuff. But marrying basically a Phoenician or a Philistine, you know, you're kind of going off the deep end here, guys, because as I said, they are culturally completely different. Now, ethnically, they're the same. They're all Semites. You know, you couldn't tell the difference looking at them except how they dress. She dressed probably more like an Egyptian because that was fashionable. We have ivory carvings. It's kind of neat to see these ivory carvings that show how... And she was quite fashionable. I mean, we'll find out later why she was quite fashionable. But there is an ivory carving of a Phoenician woman in a window. Very Egyptian looking. Very Egyptian looking in terms of her fashion. And so... nevertheless, that's what happens here. We've already looked at last week how they have these, that Elijah is sort of the guy to make Ahab's life miserable. You'll recall that Elijah has stops the rain from coming. Ahab is miserable about this. You'll recall the whole story of the contest of the prophets of Baal at Mount Carmel in chapter 18. And you'll recall the problems that he has with them. So lots of problems between Ahab and Elijah, which is kind of the signature of Ahab's life. The one thing that we're going to see about Ahab is he's got a problem with pastors. He's got a problem with pastors. Well, maybe prophets aren't really what you would call pastors. They're a lot different. But he has a serious problem with prophets because he's going to run into them a lot. Elijah isn't the only one that he runs into. Elijah is the chief one that he runs into, the one that gives him the most headaches. But there are more. There are at least five others that we'll be looking at. So this guy's got a problem with pastors. And some people do have a problem with pastors. I can tell you some people have problems with pastors. I can give you a list of their names, emails, and addresses if you're so inclined to know that. But nevertheless, but you should have figured that out before you called me to be your pastor. Oh, yeah. There are people who don't like me. In congregations, yes. It's true. One of the other problems that... our friend Ahab has has a problem of geography. Do y'all have a problem with geography? I mean, the geography around here is pretty flat. I mean, there's not a lot to describe the geography here. I keep telling people about this mysterious stuff called terrain. Perhaps you've heard of terrain. It's where you actually take your foot and stick it out in front of you, and it either goes up or down. Okay, it does that, and you could do it, as I said, and you keep doing that, and it can go up or down rather than just staying right at the same level. But I mean, geography is kind of the geography here. We got the Red River over there. It floods from time to time, and I hope it doesn't flood too bad because I live across the street from it, and that would be a problem because everybody's snickering and say, ha, 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 silly out-of-towner. He didn't know not to buy across from the river, for crying out loud. No, I had it checked. I had it cited. But nevertheless, Ahab has a problem with geography. And here's what Ahab's problem with geography is he happens to be right on the path between the folks in Mesopotamia and the folks in Egypt who don't like each other. They happen to be fighting each other quite a bit, and he happens to be right on their path. Samaria's right in there. All the good land that he has gets fought over. As I said, have you ever noticed, wouldn't it be, I have a great idea. We're right next door, just right over there, 45 minutes away, to all these lakes. I mean, they're such beautiful lakes. I don't know, maybe you've seen these lakes. They're just gorgeous. And, you can go fishing in these lakes. And wouldn't it be a great idea to put a house on one of those lakes? I think it'd be a great... Heck, there are 15,000 lakes over there that are more than a... People say 10,000 lakes. There's more than that. There's at least 15,000 of them over there, of an acre or more. Wouldn't it be great to put a house on it? I think it'd be a great idea.
Yeah.
There's only one problem with that. Somebody else has already come up with that idea. And that is a problem, is when somebody else has already come up with that idea, you're going to have some conflicts. Because if you want that land, one of two things is going to happen. Either you're going to have to get a lot of money to buy it from them, or you're going to have to use governmental powers, which includes lawyers, guns, and money, that you need to send lawyers, guns, and money to extricate them from that land, and so you get it yourself. Making sure that you have sufficient lawyers, guns, and money to defend yourself from someone else who might try to get it from you. Well, this is the problem that Ahab has, is that he is in some prime real estate that other people want because it's right on these travel routes. And also, the other thing that he's got going for him is that he has the Jezreel Valley. The Jezreel Valley. Now, again, one of the mistakes that most people make when thinking of the nation of Israel or thinking of Palestine or thinking of Canaan, land of Canaan, or whatever you want to call it, the big mistake is they think it's beige. This very dry beige, and the rocks are beige, and there are no trees, and what trees are there are dry, and there's just this dry beige land. Well, that's true in the Negev, which is the desert in the south. But we're not in the Negev. We're in the north, the region of Galilee, and in the region of Galilee, it rains there. And also in the region of Galilee, you have this other place called the Jezreel Valley, which is downright lush. Can I tell you something? This is the craziest thing. I've been there once. I'm not sure I'll go back, but I've been there at least once. It was worth going there for. Maybe I'll go back. Maybe all y'all come with me. It'd be kind of fun. Take a trip to Israel. Anybody up for it? You're up for it. Okay, well, there you go, as I said. Most people are not because they're afraid they'll get killed or something like that, which is the stupidest thing in the world. You have a better chance of getting killed here than you do there on the highways of North Dakota. It's true. They take very good care of their tourists there because guess what? It behooves both sides to take care of the tourists because that's their cash cow. But nevertheless, when I went there, you know what they're growing in the Jezreel Valley? Bananas! Now, what do you think of when you think of growing bananas? You think of a tropical, lush forest, right? Green. That's what you think of. Now, of course, you don't want green bananas. But what I'm saying is it's crazy that they have this lushness there in the Jezreel Valley even to this day. It's a great place. It's also a great place to grow something else. Grapes. It is a fabulous place to grow grapes because, yes, it's lush and green, but it's also sunny. It's very sunny. So you get a lot of sunlight, you get a lot of water, you get all kinds of stuff, the stuff that's ideal for growing grapes. Now, why on earth someone would grow grapes is beyond me. Why on earth would they do that? It just seems, how many grapes can you eat? Or what? Drink. Or drink. Now you need to understand something. Please understand this. I don't mean to step on anyone's toes by any stretch of the imagination, but let's be honest about it. You have to. There's a guy by the name of Welsh. You may have heard of him. Welsh is, he's the guy. He was a Methodist. And you know what he's famous for? No, he's famous for figuring out a way to make crushed grapes not turn into wine. Seriously. He figured out a way how to make it not turn into wine. Because you can't crush the grapes and turn it into juice without it turning into wine. You leave it there long enough, that's just what's going to happen. You see, he was Methodist, he was teetotal back in the temperance time. And that's, I'm serious, I'm not making any of this up. You can look this up. This is what the guy's famous for. Now, he did this in the 19th century. Prior to that time, you let it sit there, guess what you're going to get? You're going to get wine. All right? Now, there are several things in here that mention drunkenness within these stories. But again, this is, again, key part of all this stuff about why he's got a geography problem. The other geography problem that he has, well, we'll get to that geography problem in a little bit. But nevertheless, we kind of press on with that. Well, we'll skip over to the one geography problem. Oh, no. We'll get to the first one first. He's got another geography problem, and that's he's got a neighbor. He's got a couple neighbors that he doesn't like, but one neighbor in particular is the Syrians. Now, neighbors can be good, neighbors can be not so good, and neighbors can be from hell. You know, that's for you. And you might be the neighbor from hell. You never know. I mean, as I said to somebody, you might think you're okay, but you might have a neighbor who thinks you're the neighbor from hell. But nevertheless, he's got the neighbor from hell, and that is a guy by the name of Ben-Hadad, which I love the name Ben-Hadad. What Ben-Hadad means is it means the son of Hadad, whoever Hadad was. But Ben-Hadad was a Syrian. He was from Damascus. And the thing about Ben-Hadad is that Ben-Hadad had a better army than just about anybody out there, with the exception of the Egyptians. Ben-Hadad had chariots, which is kind of a cool thing to have if you're going to have an army. I mean, as I said, if you are going to have an army, you want all the cool toys for yourself. I mean, isn't that how we do it here? I mean, we want all the cool toys for us. We want to keep sure that our enemies don't have all the cool toys. And so that's kind of what we do. Well, Ben-Hadad had all the cool toys. And in that day, the cool toys amounted to chariots. Chariots, okay? So, he had a little bit better military might than everybody else. And so one of the better things about being a military power is that you get to push people around. And the way they pushed people around back then, this is chapter 20, by the way, we're just to let you know, we're in chapter 20, is that you, 1 Kings 20, is that what you do is you make them your vassals. I love the word vassal. It's not a word we use every day, but it here's how it works. I am the Lord, you are the vassal. Here's what happens. We enter into an agreement that you pay me this, that, and the other thing. Basically, I tax you, and for these taxes, you have the privilege of the following. You have the privilege of providing me with men for my army. So it gets worse. As I said, it stinks to be a vassal. I mean, it stinks to be a vassal. There's no two ways about it. But if there comes a time that you happen to need an army and it happens to be in my best interests, I will, in fact, come to your aid, provided it's in my best interest. You know, isn't that the way that we always do things that are our own best self-interest? I mean, isn't that the way? But Ben-Hadad was kind of that way. And so Ben-Hadad kind of said, you know, he was kind of looking at the charts here, looking at the books and say, hey, wait a minute. My vassal Ahab has not been paying up what he's supposed to be paying. So I need to go pay him a visit. And so he shows up with a big gnarly army with chariots, man. See, chariots are the cool toys. That's what all the cool kids have. Now, as we've said in this class before, chariots work real well where? Easy for you to say. Here in North Dakota, chariots would work except, you know, having an army of chariots would be great here. It would just be the best thing in the world. If you had an army full of chariots and you had more chariots than anybody else, you want to live in North Dakota. Because this is where they work. It is flat here, flat here, flat here. As I said, and it works great here. Where you don't want to do it is where my first church was. Anybody remember where my first church was?
West
West Virginia, absolutely. Chariots don't work real well there. They really, truly do not work well in places like West Virginia. Now, let me tell you this. Even though the Jezreel Valley is nice, even though parts of Galilee is nice, a lot of it is nice because it's green and lush, like the hills of West Virginia. Now, if chariots don't work well there, you've got a little bit of insulation from these guys. So he'd have to get off his chariots and get up there and sort of try to break bad. Well, so he does one day. He breaks bad on Ahab one day. He says, hey, you're behind. Here's what I want. I want your sons, your wives, and your money. Okay? In that order. And Ahab says, sure, no problem. Sure, no problem. Which is kind of how the dance was. Oh, you just have to sort of, you know, pay lip service to the schoolyard bully. I mean, that's kind of what this whole vassal thing is a lot like. It's a lot like the schoolyard bully. That's kind of what it is. So you got to say, you know, say uncle to him, and everything's fine. But he actually shows up and says, here, I want them. Give me your wives. Give me your and wives plural there, because Ahab, like every good self-respecting Oriental potentate, had a harem. And lo and behold, he said, wait a minute, this doesn't sound fun. I don't want to do this. This guy's trying to pick a fight with me. He's trying to make good on our contract. This isn't right. Doesn't he know he's not supposed to make good on the contract? He's not playing the game right. So, what does Ahab do? Actually, it's not what Ahab does. It's what God does. So God's looking down like this and says, you know, God says, you know, man, I'm not all that keen on old Ahab. But I'm really not keen on Ben-Hadad. Old Ben-Hadad, he's way out of line here. And so God sends a prophet. Now, you wonder where this guy came from. He must have come out of hiding, giving the whole episode with regard to the prophets of Baal and considering what Ahab's wife had been doing to the prophets of Israel. You kind of wonder how this guy had the nerve to show up. But nevertheless, he doesn't have a name. He shows up and says, hey, listen. Here's what y'all need to be doing. You need to be coming and fighting these guys, and we'll show you we can whip them. And guess what? That's what they do. Lesson number one, important lesson. This is an important lesson. When God gives you an insurmountable task, and when you know it's God that's giving it to you, you know what? You can take it to the bank. You can take that to the bank. Now, that seems kind of hard. Now, here's a guy with all these odds against him, because here's a guy that shows up. He's got all these chariots, man, that doesn't look good. He's got this great big army. We're going to later find out that Ahab's army looks like two little flocks of goats, and Ben-Hadad's army fills the whole stinking valley. Those don't look like good odds. But you need to understand that if God gives you his word, and God gave his word to the prophet, you can take that to the bank. And that's something that we all can learn. Regardless, get this, regardless of who we are. Because who is Ahab? Ahab is a no good, idolatrous, rotten scoundrel. That's what he is. But God says, guess what? I don't care if you're a no good, rotten, dirty scoundrel. I have good intended for you because of who knows, it's my deal. You don't have to question my business. It's my deal. To get to bless you. If I want to bless you, I'm going to bless you. And don't ask why I should bless you because you happen to be a no good, rotten, dirty scoundrel. Okay? We good on that? That's the first thing we need to realize. God can bless us. Do you know what I think is one of the great endemic challenges of ministering in the upper Midwest? I have done it for some time. Not just here, but three other churches, one in Wisconsin and two in Minnesota. Well, you know, I'm not really worthy of that blessing. How could God bless a person like me? I can't tell you the number of times I've encountered people like that here in the upper Midwest because they don't want to put on airs. Oh, man, there's the number one sin of the upper Midwest, putting on airs. Whatever you do, don't do that. This isn't putting on airs. This has nothing to do with you. It has everything to do with God. It has everything to do with God. Because, again, is Ahab a good guy? No! Ahab is an absolute bona fide rat, lousy, stinking sinner. And yet God chooses to bless him. So we got to get that through our heads, that sometimes this nonsense of thinking, I'm not worthy of God's blessing. Well, yeah, you're right. You're not worthy of God's blessing. That's true. But accept it anyway, because it's grace. By the way, that's what grace is. Grace is unmerited favor. You didn't earn it. You didn't do anything for it. It's pure grace, and God gives it. That's an important lesson that we can learn from this. Anyway, this goes back and forth a couple times. Ben-Hadad comes back and says, listen, you know, this. I know what the problem was. The fix was in. The fix was in. Their gods, I hear, are the gods of the mountains. My gods are the gods of the plains. And they tried to suck us in up in the mountains. And no wonder our chariots wouldn't work up there. So we just need to figure out a better plan to fight the gods. Well, needless to say, God is the God of all the earth, right? And to say that the God of Israel is only the God of the mountains is a bit offensive to him, wouldn't you think? Do you think that he would get a little annoyed at saying that his power is only limited to a certain piece of geography? So it comes back, and this time Ben-Hadad comes back with a seriously big army, but he captures that one too. He captures that one too, and he actually captures Ben-Hadad. And this is where he makes a mistake. He's a little soft on Ben-Hadad because it kind of gets to his head. And this is the problem of grace. That's not a problem of grace, but we need to realize we shouldn't let these things get to our head to make to think that we are all that special because we deserve God's grace. There is a serious problem, and that's kind of what happens with Ben-Hadad, is that he lets it go to his head, and he thinks, well, I'm all this. And the funny thing about it, we won't read all this because it's quite lengthy. The funny part is that Ben-Hadad says to his counselors, I better surrender. I'll surrender to, I hear that the kings of Israel are merciful. I think about that when I see that passage written down there. He says, I think the kings of Israel are merciful. And I wonder, which one is he talking about? Has he been following the story thus far? I mean, maybe there might be, he might mistake, you know, just ineptness for mercy. He might mistake just stupidity for mercy. He might mistake, well, maybe the other kings in the valley or in the area are really bad dudes and you don't want to mess with them at all. Nevertheless, they set up shop again, and they sort of, it kind of reverses. Now Ben-Hadad is the vassal to Ahab. So that's how that story ends at the end of chapter 20. But God's not real happy with this. And of course, a couple more prophets come along and say, you are a world-class nitwit, as far as I'm concerned, to let Ahab know that. All right. He's not happy. And let's kind of end it up here, because there's two words I want us to see. This prophet puts on a charade. I love the little charade that he puts on just to make him look bad, make Ahab look bad. And Ahab's kind of bummed. You know how you feel when someone does a gotcha? How do you feel when someone does a gotcha on you? I mean, don't you feel you just want to hug them and love them and say, I just thank you for giving me that gotcha. I really appreciate you sort of publicly embarrassing me with a gotcha, right? That's just how you feel, okay? Well, this prophet does a major gotcha on Ahab, and Ahab is really ticked off. And it says down here at the bottom there, it says, he became vexed and sullen because of the gotcha. So, verse 43 of chapter 20. And the king of Israel went to his house vexed and sullen and came to this guy. Just read, he pouted like a 3-year-old. Okay? That's kind of what it was. He was just pouted like a 3-year-old. We're kind of starting to see the character of Ahab. He is just an absolute rube. How did he get to be king, for crying out loud? Oh, I know how he got to be king. His dad was king before him. That's how he got to be king. Nevertheless, we move on. We're going to skip Naboth's vineyard. We're going to come back to Naboth's vineyard. Naboth's vineyard is probably the most interesting story in this whole section. But we're going to come back to that. Okay, because it's really not about Ahab as is about somebody else. Next, chapter 22. 3 years go by. 3 years go by, and a guy by the name of Jehoshaphat. I love the name Jehoshaphat, don't you? It's a great, it's Jumpin' Jehoshaphat. I have looked and looked and looked for the origin of the phrase Jumpin' Jehoshaphat. It is not to be found. Nowhere on the interweb can you find it. Gabby Hayes probably said it, but I can promise you someone in the 19th century said it before Gabby Hayes. Yes, for those of you who don't know Gabby Hayes, it would be Roy Rogers, Leonard Sly of Cincinnati's sidekick. That's the real name of Roy Rogers, by the way. Our Cowboys come from Ohio, just to let you know. It's true story. Roy Rogers' real name was Leonard Sly, and he was from Cincinnati, Ohio. Sorry to burst your bubble about that. His horse might have been named Trigger, but that wasn't what he was named. So in any case, you learn more here by accident than you do other places on purpose. You know, it's just the truth. The stuff you learn here. Nevertheless, you have Gabby Hayes saying, great Jumpin' Jehoshaphat, or whoever this is that's saying Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat's a good king. He's a king of Judah. He is the son of Asa, and Asa was a good king. But Jehoshaphat, we'll find out, he kind of goes back and forth. He does some smart things, he does some not so smart things. But on the whole, Jehoshaphat's a good guy, worships the Lord properly, and so forth. But he does one mistake. He decides to have an alliance. He just says, well, let's make peace. We should be friends. Let's just get along, okay? So he tries to make peace with Ahab. And here's how he does make peace. Boy, you talk about a boneheaded move. They have a marriage alliance. They have Ahab's daughter marries Jehoshaphat's son. How nutty is that? We'll talk about that a little bit later. But that's what happens. And so we have another situation in this particular thing where all of a sudden Ben-Hadad starts fighting again. Now, you got to ask yourself, why is that? Well, this is something that you might recall if you were following along closely, but it's just a tiny little thing. It's the tiny little things that you miss sometimes when you're reading the Bible that come back to sort of make you think, why is it all of a sudden that Jehoshaphat shows up fighting with, why is there peace, and then all of a sudden Jehoshaphat shows up, and all of a sudden they start fighting with the Syrian kings? Here's the deal. You will recall that Asa, when the other kings of Israel were causing problems for Judah, Asa went and paid off the kings of Syria to fight against Israel. So Judah is shipping arms, so to speak, to Syria to get the heat off of them. Well, now there's no more heat on because they're not doing anymore, and so now they're having to form an alliance to fight Syria themselves. Well, because Jehoshaphat's a good guy, he says, well, I got a great idea. We're going to go fight these guys. We should do this. We should ask God. I mean, that's what, you know, I mean, Christian folk will, you know, when they have encountered a problem, you know, one of the things they say, well, let's pray. Let's pray about this. Well, this is kind of what Jehoshaphat does. He says, let's pray about this. Let's call in some pastors. How about 400 pastors? That's what we need. We're sure to get agreement from 400 pastors. Come on, that's the funniest joke I've told ever in this class. Have you met any pastors, for crying out loud? They are the most contrary bunch of people that you'll ever meet. And you can't, you know, that you can get two of them agreeing upon anything is amazing. It's absolutely stunning. It's true. Present company excluded, of course. I'm not nearly as ornery as any of the others are. I thank thee that I am not like other men. Oh, dear. No. That's part of the problem. I'm exactly like other men. But as I said, he gets 400 pastors together. But they all say, because guess what? They're all on the payroll. And again, this is where you know how to tell the false prophets from the true prophets. I've said these to you before. The false prophets are on the payroll because they're the ones that will tell the king whatever he wants to hear. But again, I'm wondering, where did he get 400 prophets of the Lord from? Because I thought he was killing these people off wholesale. But nevertheless, apparently he's not. And they come up, and there's this one guy, Zedekiah. Is that his name? Is that what it is? Did I get that right? No, we're Zedekiah first. We don't... 22:11, Zedekiah, there he is. And Zedekiah is the first guy to come up with sermon illustrations and sermon props. He's got props for his illustration. He's got, and he must have already, think about this, he must have already had these pre-made for another sermon. You know, just, this shows you that pastors do indeed reuse sermons. They do. It's just, am I bursting your bubble? Oh, I'm sorry, they do all the time.
I didn't know that.
And some of them even write books and steal from other pastors. Really, they do. It's true. But it's, I hate to tell you this. I'm sort of pulling back the curtain. But nevertheless, he has these two iron horns. Now, you don't just go out and make iron horns on the spot. I mean, you know, he doesn't have like a 3D printer there, you know, that he's making these iron horns. That's another good joke. Come on, for crying out loud. We're talking 8th century BC here. They don't have 3D printers. But so he's got these iron horns. They must have been used for something else. But he says, with these iron horns, you will push back the enemy. And Jehoshaphat smells like the fix is in. I mean, he knows enough about Ahab to think, I better ask for a second opinion. And so he asked for a second opinion. He says, isn't there anybody else? And he specifically says, isn't there a prophet of the Lord? And then he says, yes, there is. This guy, Micaiah ben Imlah, or Micaiah son of Imlah, but he's a stinker. He's awful. He never prophesies anything good about me. Never, ever, 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 ever does he prophesy a good thing about me. You don't want this guy. He's just awful. He's terrible. We can't have him come here. He'll just, oh, and Jehoshaphat says, no, he's fine. He'll tell us the truth. We'll get to the truth better. Besides, we don't want to go out and battle without having a problem here because we could have a big problem. So he does this. So, let's read this because it's one of the most problematic passages in the entire Bible. Don't you love it? Aren't you glad you came here tonight? You know what? Would you mind reading? I'll stand right here so you can read briskly into the microphone. Beginning, let's just say, what verse do we want to begin with? Let's just say verse 13, okay? Of chapter 22. Read.
And the messenger who went to summon Micaiah said to him, behold, the words of the prophet with one accord are favorable to the king. Let your word be like the word of one of them and speak favorably.
Yeah, so come on, guy. Get with the program. Hey, be a team player. Okay, read on.
But Micaiah said, as the Lord lives, what the Lord says to me, that I will speak.
Yeah.
And when he had come to the king said to him, Micaiah, shall we go to Ramoth-Gilead to battle, mm-hmm. or shall we refrain? And he answered him, go up and triumph. The Lord will give it into the hand of the king.
Yeah, do like all these other nitwits said. You know, they all said, yes, let's do it. Go ahead.
But the king said to him, how many times shall I make you swear that you speak to me nothing but the truth in the name of the Lord?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I saw all Israel scattered on the mountains.
Dang.
As sheep have no shepherd.
Dang.
And the Lord said, these have no master. Let each return to his home in peace.
Why do you suppose they have no master? Because they is dead.
And the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, did I not tell you that he would not prophesy good concerning me, but evil?
Mm-hmm.
And Micaiah said, therefore, hear the word of the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
I saw the Lord sitting on his throne, and all the host of heaven standing beside him.
Now listen very carefully to this.
On his right hand and on his left. And the Lord said, who will entice Ahab that he may go up and fall at Ramoth-Gilead? And one said one thing and another said another. Then a spirit came forward. Oh, come on.
And is that what the spirit said? Oh, come on.
then a spirit came forward and stood before the Lord saying, I will entice him.
I will entice him. I'll go. Send me.
And the Lord said to him, by what means? And he said, I will go out and will be a lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets. And he said, you are to entice him and you shall succeed. Go out.
Wow. 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 Well, I mean, forget the whole business about, you know, things being foreordained and all that sort of stuff, because this obviously is the Calvinists among us would be cheering, saying, see, God has foreordained the death of Ahab, and we're going to have this happen right here and now. But there is this little problem. What is this whole idea of God sending out a lying spirit? Doesn't that trouble you? It troubles me. I mean, you wonder, well, what can I really trust? I mean, we've already run across the one lying prophet who told the southern prophet, yeah, it's okay to stay here, spend the night, we'll have dinner, and the next thing he knows, he's being dinner for a lion. We already had that one. That was a little bit problematic. Now we've got this one. This lying spirit comes up and says, front and center, and apparently this lying spirit is in the heavenly courtroom. I mean, the heavenly halls of God himself. What's he doing there?
Responding to a request from God.
Responding to a request from God. I've got a job that needs to be done. Somebody want to go do this? And all the other spirits take one step back, and there's this one guy left up front. You know, no, that's not what happens. This guy says, here, send me, I'll do it. This is a really problematic passage. I have no answer for you. Sorry. You know, there's all kinds of people that have come up with things that think they have a definitive answer for it. This is one of those cases where I think that we have to simply say, we can look at all the options, and there are plenty of options to suggest this, that, and the other thing, and I've heard lots of them. But this is one where we just have to say, this is a mystery of God, and we don't understand it. That to think that we know everything about God is problematic, to say the very least. I know we want to, you know, tighten God up, put him in a nice little box and say, here's God. There are certain things, certain parameters that we can say for certain. I mean, like we can say for certain about the Trinity, and we can say for certain about the Incarnation. You should be laughing at both of those things, because both of those things are absolute mysteries as well. There couldn't be anything more mysterious than the truth of the Trinity. There couldn't be anything more mysterious than the truth of the Incarnation. Both of those things defy our rational understanding, and yet we accept those by faith, and we hold them to be tenets of the faith, for without which we could not be considered Christian people. That those are the two things that we need to go to the mat over. And yet both of them come as mystery to us. Oh, I've heard every explanation. You know, it's like an apple. It's like an egg. It's like steam or water. They all, by the way, have some heretical notion that goes with them, every explanation, if you push them too far. It's a mystery. But this is a tough one right here. Nevertheless, God's purposes are being carried out. But here's the reaction. I love the reaction. Let's read on a little bit.
Okay. Now, therefore, behold, the Lord has put a lying spirit in the mouth of all these your prophets. The Lord has declared disaster for you.
Wow.
Then Zedekiah, the son of Chenana, came near and struck Micaiah on the cheek and said, how did the spirit of the Lord go from me?
Now, I wouldn't want Zedekiah to strike him in the cheek. You know why? What's he got? He's got them iron horns, man. That hurt. Boy, that's like having brass knuckles, okay.
And Micaiah said, behold, you shall see on that day when you go into an inner chamber to hide yourself. And the king of Israel said, seize Micaiah and take him back to Ammon, the governor of the city.
I've had this guy up to my eyeballs.
And to Joash, the king's son, and say, thus says the king, put this fellow in prison and feed him meager rations of bread and water until I come in peace. And Micaiah said, if you return in peace, the Lord has not spoken to me. And he said, hear all you peoples.
Okay. All right. Well, what happens next is pretty obvious. We can figure this one out ourselves. What's his name? Jehoshaphat, being the king that he is, wants to have his royal robes on when he goes out to fight in battle. But Ahab smells something up. It's kind of funny. So what he does is he disguises himself as just a regular soldier. You know, just your regular soldier, he just shows up like that. Well, some Syrian archer, just at random. Now, I recognize that people are going to say there's nothing random that happens on this earth. But it does, the word random actually, the Hebrew for random is used here. Randomly shoots an arrow and randomly hits Ahab between the scales of his armor, kind of like that in the Lord of the Rings, the Desolation of Smaug, and where Smaug gets hit in this bad spot. You didn't see that movie, did you? You're just looking at you and just saying, I don't know what he's talking about. He's speaking in tongues again. Stick with what fun would that be? I mean, it's all the other stuff. It's all the color commentary that... Well, where do they think they got the idea from? Anyway, so it hits him, and he's wounded, mortally wounded, and Jehoshaphat has problems there too, and so they all go scampering off, and everybody flees, and this is not good. And Ahab does make it back to Samaria, but he dies there, and his chariot is being washed out. And this is a fun little fact right here. As his chariot is being washed out of all the blood, the dogs of Samaria lick it up. And for whatever reason, the prostitutes of Samaria wash themselves in the watered-down blood of Ahab. Now, that's kind of a curious ending for a guy, you would think. So, there's our friend Ahab. We have a few more things to say about Ahab in a minute when we talk about his wife, but we'll stop there and ask if anybody has any questions about Ahab.
Was it also as bad of what the Muslims think of dogs to have this about the dog?
Absolutely.
Insult of insults.
This, it's not Muslim. It's Middle Easterners. Okay. Yeah, you could take anybody from that part of the world, and they would have this at that time and have the same sort of understanding. Yes. Yeah, you need to understand that we have this distorted understanding as Westerners about the Middle East. There are people who are ethnically Arabs and they're Christian. There are people who are ethnically Arabs who are Druze. There are people who are ethnically Arabs who are Muslims, mostly, but I'm just saying that and you couldn't tell the difference. I mean, you could sit there all day and you couldn't tell the difference. Just, you couldn't. You'll see this also in the Romans. The Romans couldn't tell the difference between Paul, who is Jewish, and an Egyptian radical who is supposed to be inciting a rebellion against. They just thought they were the same. They couldn't tell. So we make these distinctions that don't exist. They are cultural distinctions, not ethnic or racial distinctions. And we make a mistake when we do that because they don't exist in this particular. Now, there are big divisions, mind you. Don't get me wrong. I mean, they have ways of figuring out how this person's this and this person's that. You know, I can spot a Lutheran a mile away because they're not in church on Sunday. No. It's the truth. Yeah, this is a true story. When I started being a pastor, there were if you added up all the Lutherans, who's the other one? Gallup did a poll, 18 million Lutherans supposedly in the United States. If you added up all the Lutherans in the Missouri Synod, the ELCA, and all the other splinter bodies, it worked out to be about 6 million baptized, which means there were twice as many people saying they were Lutheran who weren't a member of any Lutheran denomination anywhere. Twice as many. So that somebody's going around asking you the question, yeah, I have a family like that. I do. And but on top of that, think of all the people who are on baptized rolls who are basically Christmas and Easter. So, yeah, I know how to spot a Lutheran, absolutely. Bob, you're going to say something. You have a rebuttal to my rather snide comment against Lutherans?
No.
Oh, no, I did. Perish the thought, yeah.
Ahab.
Yes.
So when the dogs and the
prostitutes
were doing this, it was the ultimate denunciation of Ahab?
Absolutely, the ultimate humiliation of Ahab. And this is the thing. This is why, I mean, humanly speaking, there are certain things which degrade an enemy that you do to degrade an enemy. And this is one of them. Well, like cannibalism. I mean, the whole purpose of cannibalism worldwide, wherever there is practiced, is plain and simple, is the humiliation of an enemy, period. Whether it was in Scandinavia, whether it was in New Guinea, whether it was in Central America or South America, no matter where it was practiced, the whole idea was the degradation of an enemy. That was the whole thing. This is what I think of you. Okay, so in any case, again, that's pan-cultural. Wherever that was practiced, that's what the practice was. Okay, all right.
What's the answer to the question in verse
1066?
39.
Verse 39, what's the question?
Now the rest of the acts of Ahab and all that he did and the ivory house that he built and all of the cities that he built.
You're going to love this answer.
Are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel?
You know, if you find that book, you're going to be in good shape, man. You'll be set. You'll be buying more Hudson Hornets. Okay. You'll be buying more nicer ones too. Okay. Absolutely, you'll be buying lots of them because
you'll be a rich guy.
There are some books that the books of Kings and Samuel and other books talk about that we don't have.
The book of the Chronicles of the Kings.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a couple of them like that. We don't have them.
They're not referring to the Chronicles.
They're not necessarily, no, because they're definitely not referring to the Chronicles, because here's the thing. The kings of Israel are not mentioned in Chronicles. Oh, okay. Only occasionally and only obliquely. The book of Chronicles is about the kings of Judah almost exclusively.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so we know that it's not that.
So another mystery.
Sorry, man. More questions than answers.
I came here to get answers.
Well, you came to the wrong place. I came here to give you questions, man.
Yeah.
That's what I came here for. All right. Anything else? Ready to hit Jezebel? I knew you would. Jezebel, hot diggity. Love to talk to me about Jezebel. Holy cats. Let's find it here. All right. Where is she at here? She's in here somewhere. There's Ahab. No, I'm looking at my notes. Oh, there she is. Okay. All right. Here's the thing about Jezebel. We know that she comes from a royal family of the Sidonians. Oh, by the way, here's a fancy picture of one of these Sidonian females hanging out in a window, by the way. The window is kind of, I'm not very good at the preparing, am I? No, I'm not very. I should have PowerPoints and color slides and all that. So, like all the cool pastors do, and all that sort of stuff. There she is, kind of. She looks like an Egyptian, but this piece came from the coast of modern day Lebanon, so we know this is a Sidonian piece. But she looks very Egyptian. No. I got my notes on here. And then you're going to copy my notes and start teaching. Yeah. That's. Not going to do that. Don't get grabby on me.
That's a prime source.
That's right. Goodness gracious. In any case, she really is the source of all. I shouldn't say the source of the apostasy. She is the fire. She's the gasoline on the fire. Ahab already has the fire of idolatry going, but she truly is the gasoline to that. She is ready to go. She is primed for this stuff. You got to remember, her dad was the priest of Asherah, so she's kind of into all that sort of stuff. She saw her father kill the guy to become king. So this is all kind of normal for her. This is, I don't know what normal is in your family. I should tell you what normal is in my family, but my wife and my son are here, and they would probably not corroborate what I have to say, because I'd probably try to say nice things, which you all know is not true. But nevertheless, what normal in your family is what's normal, not necessarily. I mean, you kind of see stuff, you think, well, isn't this how? I'll give you an example of what's normal. In my family, my family that I grew up in, normal is this, that you go to four different elementary schools. That's normal. You go to four different elementary schools because the people I hung around with and I lived next door to, all their dads were NCOs in the Air Force. And they'd get moved around and they'd get moved around and they'd get moved around and, they'd get gone to the next place and go on to the next place and go on to the next place. And I thought that was normal. I thought that was normal until I started talking to people in the congregations I've been serving. And guess what? Not only is that not normal, but normal for them is knowing people from kindergarten up until they're 60, 70 years old. That's normal for them. That's not normal for me. That's very abnormal. Well, what's normal for Jezebel is idolatry, sensuality, cult prostitution, murder, power grabbing. That's what's normal for her. That's what's normal in her life. Now, she's quite the character, and she exhibits this right and left. We see this right out of the bat, but she's the one that seems to be causing all the problems. Well, I shouldn't say that. She seems to be the one who's exacerbating all the problems. She makes them a lot worse than they already are. As I said, if it wasn't bad enough that Ahab was the way Ahab was, but he has got himself a Jim Dandy of a wife. Now, this is only one of his wives, you need to understand. But apparently, she is like the chief wife. I mean, because he has a harem, and so she's a part of that. This obviously was a political alliance, because Ahab wanted to make nice with the people of the Phoenicians, which is not really a smart thing to do. Judah's not doing it. I mean, after all, David's killing Goliath, for crying out loud. You know, that's what's going on down in the southern kingdom. Nevertheless, that's what happens with her. Okay. Then we see her again, because we know that she is that what she's doing is not only a devotee of Baal and all that. So she is arch enemy. I mean, an arch enemy of the worship of the Lord as prophets. She is truly someone who is out to completely do in the true worship of God. She is out to do in the true worship of God. Now, this is something that's a little bit different. You know, there is the sense of, you know, certain individuals will just say, but why can't we just live together in peace and harmony? Why can't, you know, those people worship the way they want to worship, and we'll worship the way we want to worship? That's not what Jezebel's about. That's not her agenda. Her agenda is to make sure that the worship of God, how God is supposed to be worshiped, is eliminated. Which would make her what? Demonic.
Psychopathic.
Psychopathic, yes, but demonic too. Because if you are that much opposed to the true worship of God, there could only be one option. She's demonic. I mean, there's just no getting around it. She is, you know, has a systematic approach to killing off the prophets. She has a systematic approach to, you know, basically the institution of Baal worship in the capital of Israel. She, over and over again, you could see what she's doing. And, you know, here's the thing about the demonic. As I said before, the devil doesn't show up in a red union suit with a pitchfork and a tail and horns. Okay? For that generation, if you're in that generation. Or if you're in the black t-shirt with the pentagram and the goat's head on it, if you're that generation, the devil doesn't show up wearing that either. Nor does the devil wear Prada. But that's another story. But devil wants to be subtle, does not want to be seen, does not want to be noticed. She operates in the halls of power, and she does some other great and sneaky stuff. Let's read about the great and sneaky stuff that she does. Anybody feel like reading? You want to read again? Sure, okay. Chapter 21. This is the story of Naboth's vineyard. Okay, read on.
Now, Naboth the Jezreelite had a vineyard in Jezreel.
That's where, if you were a Jezreelite, it would be a good idea to have a vineyard in Jezreel, okay? That's just sort of like the other day we were talking about stone them to death with stones. What else? You know, you're not going to use sponges, okay? Read on.
Beside the palace.
And it was a vineyard, remember that? And it was where? In Jezreel, this really lush, great place for doing what? Growing grapes. Ah, bowling trophy for you. Absolutely. Growing grapes. Read on. And where else is it?
Beside the palace.
It's beside the palace. Hey, you know, here's the thing. This is something I learned about real estate. I learned this about real estate. You don't want the best house in the neighborhood. You want somebody else to have the best price of the house in the neighborhood, so the price of your real estate goes up. That's how it works. That's how it works. You want not a bad house, but if you have the best house, their real estate is driving you down. He's next door to the guy with the best house in the neighborhood, who happens to be the king, meaning this guy's in tall cotton. Read on.
And after this, Ahab said to Naboth, give me your vineyard that I may have it for a vegetable garden.
Wow.
It's near my house, and I will give you a better vineyard for it. Or, if it seems good to you, I will give you its value in money.
Mm-hmm.
But Naboth said to Ahab, the Lord forbid that I should give you the inheritance of my fathers.
Yeah.
And Ahab went into his house vexed and sullen.
Pouting like a three-year-old. There he is again, vexed and sullen, pouting like a three-year-old. Basically, Naboth says, I can't do this. Even if I wanted the cash, I can't do this because we got this rule, and the rule's this, that you don't get rid of a family inheritance. You don't do that. You can't do that. It's got to be redeemed. It's got some, you know, if I were to sell it to somebody, I'd have to sell it to a close relative. So there would be the possibility of me buying it back when I got more money. I can't do it. But does Ahab care about the law of Moses? Apparently not. It makes him pout like a three-year-old. Read on.
Because of what Naboth the Jezreelite had said to him. For he had said, I will not give you the inheritance of my fathers.
Yes.
And he lay down on his bed and turned away his face and would not eat food.
Pouted like a three-year-old. Did I say that already? Is there anything here that disagrees with him pouting like a three-year-old? Keep on going there.
But Jezebel, his wife, came to him and said to him,
Why
is your spirit so vexed that you eat no food? And he said to her, because I spoke to Naboth the Jezreelite and said to him, give me your vineyard for money, or else, if it please you, I will give you another vineyard for it.
Mm-hmm.
And he answered, I will not give you my vineyard. And Jezebel, his wife, said to him, Do you now govern Israel? Arise and eat bread and let your heart be cheerful. I will give you the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite.
Mm-hmm.
So she wrote letters in Ahab's name.
Wow, forger.
And sealed them with his seal.
Forger, by the way, they have found a ancient Near Eastern seal from the 8th or 9th century BC with Jezebel's name on it. Looks just like a royal seal. They actually have a little archaeological. Of course, anytime you find that sort of evidence, people go nuts. You know, you've got the one group saying, oh, no, it's not real. And the other group saying it absolutely proves it all. But again, it doesn't prove anything except for the fact it corroborates the idea that Jezebel was a very real sort of name back then. But it is interesting. Read on. But she wasn't using her seal, by the way. She was using his. Okay.
And she sent the letters to the elders and the leaders who lived with Naboth in his city. And she wrote in the letters, proclaim a fast and set Naboth at the head of the people and set two worthless men opposite him.
Wow.
And let them bring a charge against him, saying, you have cursed God and the king.
Mm.
Then,
like she cares about cursing God. Like that really bothers her. You've cursed God and the king. Oh, like she's actually concerned about cursing God. She does it on a regular basis. I mean, for crying out loud, not only is she a forger, not only is she deceitful, but she's a hypocrite. Goodness gracious sakes alive. But does she care? No. She probably puts her head on the pillow and sleeps well at night. Keep going. Because their head's all that's left. You'll find out about that in a little bit.
Then take him out and stone him to death.
Mm-hmm.
And the men of his city, the elders and the leaders who lived in his city, did as Jezebel had sent word to them.
Mm-hmm.
As it is written in the letters that she had sent to them, they proclaimed a fast and set Naboth at the head of the people.
Mm-hmm.
And the two worthless men came in and sat opposite him.
Mm-hmm.
And the worthless men brought a charge against Naboth in the presence of the people, saying, Naboth cursed God and the king. So they took him outside the city and stoned him to death with stones.
Mm.
Then they sent to Jezebel.
Murderer! Add murderer by there.
Naboth has been stoned. He is dead. As soon as Jezebel heard that Naboth had been stoned and was dead, Jezebel said to Ahab, arise, take possession of the vineyard.
And thief.
Of Naboth the Jezreelite, which he refused to give you for money, for Naboth is not alive, but dead. And as soon as Ahab heard that Naboth was dead,
he stopped pouting.
Ahab arose to go down to the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite to take possession of it. Then the word of the Lord came to Elijah the Tishbite, saying...
Okay, so stop here. All right. So Elijah's going to break bad. Elijah picks back up again and basically says, tell him he's toast. tell him that things aren't going to go well for him. But here we see, this is the classic example of Jezebel. This really is her story right here. And we see her utter and complete wickedness. We see her callousness. We see her just as she is. And it is nothing but stunning and amazing. Nevertheless, I think it's important for us to get a picture of who she is. Then the Lord of the Lords came to Elijah the Tishbite, saying, "Arise, go down and meet Ahab, king of Israel, who's in Samaria. Behold, he is in the vineyard of Naboth, who took possession. And you shall say to him, 'Thus says the Lord, have you killed and also taken possession, you rat?'" I didn't say that, but actually I just kind of put that in there. "And you shall say to him, 'Thus says the Lord, in the place where the dogs licked up the blood of Naboth, the dogs will lick your own blood.'" So we already heard that that's what happens. Okay. All right. Now, Ahab says to Elijah, "Have you found me, O my enemy? Have you found me? Because I have found you because you have sold yourself to do what's evil in the sight of the Lord. And behold, I will bring disaster upon you, and I will utterly burn up you, and I will cut off from Ahab every male bond or free." Now, in the King James Bible, that is a very fun little passage right there. Hebrew is an incredibly graphic language, by the way, just kind of let you know that. And I don't know why. It's the junior high boy in me that likes saying the word pisseth. You know, people say that's kind of a vulgar thing for the pastor to say. Well, why does it appear six times in the King James Bible? Because the King James Bible is archaic and didn't know how to translate the word, I think it's sa'ar here, which means, no, satan, which in Hebrew means to urinate. Because this is meant to be derogatory. This is meant to be mocking. That I'm going, that these guys, that they're just so lazy that wherever they happen to be, if they happen to need to go to the bathroom, they just unzip and let it flip, so to speak. If you'll pardon that vulgarism. Yeah, I know. It's on tape too, Becky. That's even worse yet. But the King James has the word "every male that pisseth against the wall." And there's something that's trying to be explained here. There's something that's trying to be said here. And because of our Victorian sensibilities, who get really offended at stuff like this, we lose the emphasis here. The emphasis here is that this is a vulgar guy, and we're going to cut off all the vulgar people from this person. And that's what's going to happen. We're going to see this again. But again, it's 1 Kings 21:21. Fun little fact. But don't tell your kids, because, you know, kids aren't supposed to be talking like that. Adults, we can talk like that. How's it translated in there? Every male.
Every male bond or free in Israel?
Yeah, I know. Isn't that a drag? It's male. It's the whole thing.
It's like you're just making up what you just said.
You think I'm making it up? Somebody get a King James Bible out, please, please, please. Somebody please get out a King James Bible and show that it's not. You can find it yourself. You know, you're just picking on me, Becky. See what I mean about two pastors can't agree upon the same thing? See what I mean?
Aren't you glad I showed up?
I'm very good.
It was getting kind of quiet in here.
It was getting... It's in the book. I did not write the book. It's in the book. 1611, for crying out loud. Absolutely.
I'm glad we read the ESV.
In any case, let's turn to, but nevertheless, Ahab in chapter 21, verse 25, he repents. It says, and there was, 25 says, "And there was none like him who sold himself to do what was evil in the sight of the Lord, whom Jezebel, his wife, incited, and he acted very abominably, going after the idols and the Amorites," and so forth and so forth. "And when Ahab heard these things, he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth, and he repented. And God said, 'Guess what, Ahab? It's not going to happen in your lifetime, but I'm going to tear everybody down anyway.' So he humbled himself." So isn't it funny that Ahab repents for a little while? Okay, now the demise of Jezebel. Jezebel lives 14 years beyond Ahab. So she's... Got in the jam there. Okay.
It's a King James Version.
It's a King James Version. I don't know about that, you know.
A little more dramatic.
Give him a trophy.
Give him a trophy. You know, I just give him a trophy. Give him a bowling, give him a Homer trophy. That's what I'll give him. All right. Chapter 9. There's this guy named Jehu that shows up. Chapter 9 of 2 Kings. 2 Kings chapter 9. Jehu shows up. And Jehu is a, man, this guy's a man on a mission. He's one bad dude. But he is a man on a mission, and God gives him a mission and says, here's what you're going to do. You're going to go kick butt and take names, and you're going to go wipe out the house of Ahab for me. You're going to do the cutting off from Ahab, all the guys that are doing what they're doing, all 70 of them. But that's not what we want to get at. Ahab, Jehu is charged with a specific task. His specific task is that he is to go not only kill Joram. Joram is the king of Israel. And then after killing Joram, his job is to go finish the task with young lady Jezebel. And here's how all that happens. After doing the, what he does, he, well, let's read. It's fun to read. Okay. So chapter 9:14 talks about his assassination of Joram and Ahaziah, two guys that should have known better. Then with verse 30 is where we begin our final little task here with Jezebel. When Jehu came to Jezreel, remember Jezreel, Jezebel heard of it, and she did what? If you like them painted up and powdered up, then you ought to be glad, because your good girl's going to turn bad. And more from the Johnny Cash choir later. But in everything, that's not Johnny Cash, by the way, just to let you know. But the nice little rendering there. But anyway, your good girl's going to turn bad. She's nothing good about those. She paints herself up. She painted her eyes, adorned her head, and looked out the window. And as Jehu entered the gate, and she said, is it peace, you Zimri? That's a nasty thing to say to somebody, calling him a Zimri. What's a Zimri? Zimri's the guy that was king for 7 days, who committed regicide, who murdered the master king. Now, again, only a little bit of hypocrisy here, because what did her daddy do? Her daddy came to power by murdering a king and committing regicide. She is just so such a hypocrite. It isn't funny. I mean, she's rotten to the core, like Krabby Appleton. Anyway, you murderer of your master. And he lifted up his face to the window and said, who is on my side? Who? And two or three eunuchs looked out and said at him. Now, you need to understand, who are these eunuchs up there and why are they eunuchs? No, because they're not DOS. Oh, that kind of eunuch. I'm sorry. Sorry. Bad. It's pretty lame joke, huh, Ian? It's actually pretty good. It's pretty funny. Because eunuchs with an S on it, with this plural, it sounds like... Oh, well. Okay. No, it's an operating system for... Yes, but it's kind of at a machine level and that sort of... Yes. Yeah. No, they still use it today. Yes, they do. Just a dumb joke, that's all. Okay. Keep reading. I'm stretching, Becky. You murder, and lift up, the eunuchs became eunuchs. They did not get the clippity clip. They got the choppity chop. You remember there's the clippity clip and the snippity snip? These guys got the choppity chop. You know, the clippity clip is, of course, getting circumcised. The snippity snip is, of course, getting a vasectomy. The choppity chop means they chop those rascals all the way off. And the reason why they do this, I'm not making this up either. Don't tell me that I'm just doing the junior high boy thing. They do this to keep the queen safe from sexual advances of her male servants. So that's what they do this for. But they became very trusted because, after all, you know, what little enjoyment they could have in life was because they could be next to the queen and have all the good stuff that the queen's got. Well, guess what? All they have to do is look down at Jehu and say, this guy means business. We're switching teams right now. And they switch teams. And what do? And again, this is why Hollywood has not done their homework. Because if Hollywood's doing their homework, they'd be making this into a movie right here. Okay?
And they looked up, and two of the three eunuchs looked out and said, throw her down. So they threw her down, and some of her blood spattered on the wall on the horses, and the horses trampled. It's bad enough, the blood spattering on the wall. That would not be fun. But how would you like it if the blood that you fell down got spattered on the wall, and then, if there was any life left in you, the horses trampled you? That's not much fun, is it? Okay. Then they went and ate and drank. So they went down to the local inn, had themselves a meal, and then it says, oh, see now to this cursed woman, bury her, for she is a king's daughter. That's awful noble of you, Jehu, to say that. But when they went to bury her, I love this part right here. This is the great part. They found no more of her than her skull and the feet and the palms of her hands. And when they came back and told him, says, this is the word of the Lord, which he spoke by Elijah the Tishbite, his servant. In the territory of Jezreel, the dogs shall eat the flesh of Jezebel, and the corpse of Jezebel shall be dung as on the face of the field in the territory of Jezreel, so that no one can say, this is Jezebel. As my niece Emily said, this is a T-Rex. He will bite you and eat you, and you will be poop forever. Again, but going back to this sense of how the desecration of the enemies, how could you be more desecrated than having the dogs consume you so much that the only thing left of you is your skull and the palms and feet of your hand, your palms, your hands, and your feet. And then they defecate you all throughout the land. And this is Jezebel. But it's not. Unfortunately, the spirit of Jezebel lives on. We encounter the Jezebel spirit in Revelation chapter 2, verse 20. And yet this whole spirit, this whole similarity between those people who defy God himself and would turn God's people away. You'll read about them in Revelation chapter 2, verse 20. And so this is something that we still to this day need to be on our guard against. This is it's a cautionary tale, but it also is a tale that recognizes that this isn't just a historical individual, but this is a type of scripture, a type of people who are bent on evil, a type of people who are bent on defying God. And yet God will still have the final victory in all. So that's Jezebel. Any comments, questions, thoughts about our friend Jezebel?
Is there anything symbolic about skull, hands, and feet?
The dog just plain couldn't eat it. That's all. That's pretty much it right there. I don't think there's anything symbolic about it. I just think that it's that we're down to the we got that thing stripped as much as we can. As much indigestion as the dogs could stand. Absolutely. Yeah, there's nothing symbolic. Well, I shouldn't say nothing. I don't know. I would be inclined to say no, there's nothing symbolic about it. Now, interestingly enough, in the next scene, if this isn't grisly enough for you, it does get worse. It does get worse. Oh, yes, it does. And Jehu is the guy who helps make it get worse. And it's funny how Jehu pretty much keeps his hands clean. He's just such a bad dude that people are the baddest dudes in the valley are absolutely terrified of this guy because he's got the Holy Ghost on him somehow. I mean, he's got God's mojo on this guy. And he's Jehu. He starts out as a commander of the Lord. He actually witnessed what went on at Naboth's vineyard. He saw what Jezebel had done. He's the commander of the Ahab's army, one of the commanders. And he's sitting around knocking down a few beers or whatever it is, a glass of wine or whatever it is, because I know you're not supposed to be drinking beers. Wine's okay, right? Because it's actually grape juice. No. So he's knocking back a few. And Elisha, who we haven't gotten yet, goes and tells one of his little servants and says, go find me Jehu. And here's the list of things that he's got a to-do list for Jehu. Number one is, you're going to be anointed king. That's the first thing. Number two is, you're going to go kill the current king. And it just so happens that the king of Judah, who is cousins with the current king, because, remember Mom? Mom is the daughter of Ahab. Now, this is an interesting thought here. Adaliah is the woman's name, who's the daughter. Adaliah is the woman's name, and she is the mother of the next king of Judah. Actually, the next two kings of Judah. But have you ever thought about this? Who's her mother? Her father is likely Ahab. If you see who she is, she looks an awful lot like Jezebel. But before you say it's Jezebel, I want you to think about this. If Jezebel is the mother of Adaliah, and Adaliah is the mother of one of the kings of Judah, do you know what it means? It means that Jezebel is in the lineage of somebody else we know. Yeah, see, we don't want to say it. She is definitely the daughter of Ahab.
Okay, but we don't know.
Well, we don't know that. That's true.
So I would say no.
Yeah, well, you would cross your fingers and say no, because the most thinking is that, well, actually, there are three possibilities. That she is the daughter of Jezebel, she is the daughter of one of Ahab's other wives, or she is the sister of Ahab. In any case, she's related to Ahab. That's bad enough. But, I mean, it's true. Somehow you gotta account. I mean, well, let's face it. If you read the story of Adaliah by herself, she's pretty rotten. I mean, she doesn't need to be related to anybody else to be rotten, and she is. But nevertheless, that's another story. So, other questions about our friends? Yes, Mickey.
Not a question, but growing up, Frankie Lane warned me about Jezebel.
Frankie Lane warned me about Jezebel. There is a song to that. That, well, you know, she is in the annals of history. She's remembered as being, just like Ahab's remembered as being wicked, she's also remembered as being wicked. She's a byword of that, just as Ahab and Jeroboam are bywords of wickedness. So, yeah. Not your cheeriest lesson today, is it? Not your cheeriest lesson. But nevertheless, it's in the book. And again, I think it would make for a great movie. Absolutely. You wouldn't have to change a great deal, would you? So. Anybody want to pray us out of here? I can do that if you don't want to. Let's do it. Father, thank you for your word, even the parts that are cautionary tales. Remind us, Lord, that grace is available even to the most wicked, such as Ahab. Remind us that you show blessings even upon the wicked, that you cause the rain to fall on the just and the unjust. Remind us of these things. And remind us also, Lord, that you are a God not only of merciful, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love, but you are a God true to his word, and you indeed are a God of justice as well. And so we keep that mind, Lord, as the merciful. You cry out for your mercy and justice in Jesus' name.